This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at REACH 2015, a conservative Anabaptist ministry convention hosted by Faith Builders on March 19 and 20, 2015.
Good afternoon. I'd like to have this opportunity to share with you this afternoon. And I thought before we get going here a little bit, I'd like to know who's here and maybe a little bit why you're here, who you are, and what you do, what is your interest in this class, who's here, how many teachers, school teachers are in this class, okay, nice number of teachers. How about people who work in maybe a kids club ministry of some kind, or a lot more, okay, well, that's who's here, kids club ministry, all right. How about Vacation Bible School? Have you ever taught the Vacation Bible School? Or would you like to? Someone kind of saw me have done that. How about just have an honorary kid brother? Some of those too? Alright. I was wondering also, I was thinking about here this past week, there's a boy that I'm friend with. He's 19 years old. He was at camp about 3 years ago, and he's kind of going through some difficult times. Now that he's out camp, and another friend of mine just gave him a job, employed him, and gave him a job. And I'm pretty sure that he made a job where there wasn't a job for this young man, just out of just his sense of mission for helping this young man. Is any of you here employers or people who maybe work with a young man like that? Just needs a job, needs to learn how to work. And you want to talk about any employers? Kind of people? So yeah. All right. I think there's something here for anyone. And I want to talk about young people today. And I also want to, by the grace of God, help you and me look at ourselves to maybe learn some things that will help us prepare us, by God's grace, to do a good job in working with troubled children. I certainly don't have any kind of recipes or kind of slick, easy way to work with troubled children, but I have a few thoughts, and I want to tell you up front, mostly it's about you. It's about you and what happens in your heart. So that you're prepared to go to trouble. Father, I ask for your presence here as we spend a little time together here in this workshop. Father, we know that children are in trouble, young people are in trouble, are close to your heart. And so we just ask you to work in our lives so that we can reach out. And Lord, we just ask for your healing from our own trouble, our own sin, our own problem, so that we can in turn reach out. Pray for your presence and spirit. Also, I wanted to, before we get started, mention a book that I think is a good book and it's fairly easy to read. It's a book that's called Their Name Is Today, written by Johann Arnold, Reclaiming Childhood in a Hostile World. I'm not saying that I agree with everything in this book, but there's some really good thoughts in this book. And it's produced by the Bruderhof communities. And I have a friend in the Bruderhof community who donated enough books for all of you to have them. And they're in a box in the back. You can go buy one for $11 on Amazon, or you can take one free from this workshop today. And thank Bruderhof for that. And I appreciate their gift to me and to you in this class. What do we need to understand about young people today? I think that just to get us started, what are areas that have impacted the young people that you and I work with in whatever our responsibility is, as a school teacher or a kids club helper or a parent or a foster parent, whatever the case may be. What are the things that impact the young people of today? And to be honest with you, it's a long list. And I kind of worked through different things, and I decided to just kind of zeroed in on these four areas of impact that I think are important for us to think about. We're going to try it all to understand the young people that we're working with, and then from there go into some things that we can do to minister to young people. But four areas of impact that I think are impacting young people today in a way that is fairly recent. This is, I think, in the last 20, 30 years, things have changed dramatically in our culture. And one huge area of impact is that I have here in these four areas, I have three that are too much of and one too little of. But in our culture today, in our families, our communities, children are on too much medication. Psychotropic medication in the United States has 5% of the world's population, and we use 90% of the world's psychotropic drug. Psychotropic medicine is designed to help change behavior. And so 90% of the world's psychotropic drugs are used in America. Clearly, we're using too much. A boy today is 30 times more likely to be on medication than what he was in 1987. And in my role at camp, we work with a lot of boys and families that have used medication to try to manage the behavior that boys are struggling with. And we often try to help a boy get off of medication so that we can actually help him with the problem. And, in working with doctors and counselors, we've learned that actually doctors already know that we're on too much medication. People who prescribe the medication are very aware that they're prescribing too much medication. But basically what's happened in our culture is that a parent or a person who has custody of a troubled child goes to a doctor and says, could you put this child on medication because, and they don't say this part, because I don't have time to spend with this child. I'm not going to do what I need to do to try to help this child overcome his areas of difficulty, so could you please put him on medication? So the doctor is being asked to do something that he just simply does. Now, not all that is said in those conversations, but that's essentially what's going on. And so doctors admit that. When I talk to them from camp, doctors and teachers and parents often admit that we're taking too much medication, but we're unwilling to maybe do the things that are more effective. So we ask the doctor to do something, and then he does what we ask. And put this child on medication and give him a diagnosis and all those kind of things. And the real tragic part about being on too much medication, and by the way, don't hear me say that you should never get on medication. That's not what I'm saying. I think there's times where some type of psychotropic medication is appropriate and even helpful for a troubled child, particularly to help them deal with the stress that's involved in academics, and I'll talk about that a little later. But I'm not saying that we should never use medication. I'm just simply saying that we're using it way too much. The tragic part about this is that medication that's prescribed and legal eventually often turns into drug abuse later in life. For this young person, becomes dependent on some kind of medication to help them get through the day, and eventually turns to other ways of using drugs to help them get through the day that are illegal and abusive and not prescribed by others. So an area of impact is too much medication. The second area of impact, we all know this, that our children of today are having too much screen time, and that could be a number of different ways that we're looking at a screen. But if you go in houses today, in most families or houses in our culture, there's a screen in almost every room. Probably is a screen in almost every room except the bathroom, and that's really where it should be so we can put it in the toilet. But there's the screen in the bedroom, there's a screen in the living room, there's a screen in the dining room. We're always looking at a screen. If we're not looking at one in each room, we're carrying one around. And so children are looking at a screen 24/7 almost, phones, computers, television, or whatever, and obviously this is the technology of today is very useful and helpful, and there's a lot of good things that can be done with it, but it's just way overdone. Boys spend 13 hours a week playing video games. Girls spend about 5 in our culture. That's just video games. And that may not sound like a lot of hours, except for the simple fact that those same children are spending less than 1 hour sitting at a meal table with their family, right? So something is out of balance when we spend all our time looking at the screen. And something that could be potentially good becomes very bad, particularly for younger children, children under 13 or 15. A third area that I believe is impacting youth of today that we need to understand is that too much education pressure. I was asked to share this workshop by Faith Builders, and Faith Builders is really into education, I think. That's kind of what they do, so I hesitated to use this one. I almost didn't talk about this, but it's pretty close to my heart. I and my fellow camp get a chance to get in public schools all around the state, Pennsylvania and Maryland. I've been in many public schools, I'm sure more than most people have, and as I evaluate what I see when I go into public schools, it's not a good thing. The teachers and the staff at these public schools are always talking about federally mandated standards, core curriculum, that they have to pass all these tests so that we can get this child to do what he's got to do and take certain tests. We've got to study these certain things. And the things that we're studying aren't even all that good. And many teachers readily admit that we wish we didn't have to do it, but we have to do it. It boils down to money. The federal government is requiring requiring schools to pass certain tests. And that pressure gets passed on to children and families to basically sit in a classroom and study things that are boring and really aren't all that useful in life. But we got to do it to pass the test. And I think that has made education a real problem, particularly for a problem child or a child who has some of the other problems that we already talked about. He's not going to be able to stand up under that education pressure. The other part about education is education without a purpose, and I believe that Faith Builders does understand this part very well. They believe in high academic standards, but they also believe in education with a purpose. There's a reason to get educated, and there's a story about a boy that asked his father, and this may have been you, I know it was me when I was going to school, "Why do I need to go to school, Dad?" And so, this is not my dad's answer. My dad had some other answers. But the boy asked his father why he needs to go to school, and his father said, "Well, you need to go to school so you can graduate from high school. Why do I need to graduate from high school so you can go to college and graduate from college? Well, why do I need to go to college so you can get a good job? Well, why do I need to get a good job so you can make lots of money? So why do I want to make lots of money so I can buy lots of nice things? Why do I want to buy nice things? Well, I want to buy nice things so I can retire early and enjoy all my money. And why do I want to retire early and enjoy all my money so that I can die and give it all to my children?" Really, what is the purpose, right? What is the purpose for education? There needs to be a purpose beyond the American dream or whatever you call it. If we're just simply getting an education for the sake of education or for the sake of earning money and kind of going through the same American dream, there has to be a bigger purpose. So I think it's a real problem. It impacts children of today. We have education that's a lot of pressure to meet certain standards and also pressure without purpose. I think it impacts our children across our culture, but particularly the troubled children. The fourth area of impact is truly what I think is the most tragic, and that is too little family. Too much medication, too much screen time, too much education, but too little family. And I think that this is where the true tragedy lies as we work with our children today. And you know these numbers, this is starting to get kind of old hat for us. 24 million children living in America, living in a home without their biological father. Just for sake of comparison, the population of Pittsburgh is about 1 million, okay? So that's a big city, Pittsburgh. And 24 million children in America today live in a home where their biological father is not living with them. I don't have to tell you that families are broken, but what I'm simply trying to tell you is that families are really broken in our country. The amazing thing is that what I'm observing as we go along through this problem of having too little family, what I'm observing is that the children that are being born today are born to parents who were also born to unmarried children, okay? So we're talking about a couple of three generations now. You might have to go back to grandparents or even before to find a couple that was actually married to each other and raised their children in a two-parent family. And that's becoming more and more common in our nation. In 1950, 4% of children were born to unmarried moms, and as you go through 1990, about a quarter of the population was born to unmarried moms, and by 2008, 41% of babies born in America are born to unmarried moms. And if you take that and you also add to it those who separate before a child is two, you have over 50% of the children being born in America today are living in single-parent families or in a family where one of the biological parents. Just this week, my boys that are at our camp, and by the way, we get to work with some really special families at our camp, and some families that are working real hard, some of them to try to do what God wants them to do to raise their children. But just this week, I went and looked at the list of boys in our family as I was preparing for this talk, looked at our list of boys, and there's 23 boys at camp, three of them live with their mom and dad, of the boys that we work with at camp. This is a really bad problem. I'm just trying to, I know you know this, but I'm just trying to say that it really is bad, and it impacts an awful lot of things. Everything that you can think about that has to do with working with children is impacted by this idea of two little family. It impacts gender issues. That's a big deal in our culture today, right? When you have single parents trying to raise their children, or even children are being raised by uncles or grandparents or whatever, those boys particularly, but girls also, are going to struggle with gender issues. Who I am, and what does it mean to be a man? And that those roles will get confused. It's creating huge issues in our culture today, and I believe that this idea of two little family impacts almost everything else we're talking about today. Judith Wallerstein, in her book, or actually in her study, The Unexpected Legacy of Divorce, she followed a group of families for a period of 25 years. Very interesting book. She follows a group of families for 25 years, and she evaluates what happens to families who stay together, families who divorce, children that grow up in single-parent families. And one thing that she found was that children that followed children for 25 years showed that those who are closely involved with their fathers at age 5 were more empathetic as adults, were happier as husbands and as parents than those who had not experienced a close relationship with their own fathers a quarter of a century earlier. The point is that the effects of broken family goes with us for the rest of our lives. I think that's what she's discovering in her 25 years. And incidentally, Judith Wallerstein is a secular writer. This is not a Christian author. This is not necessarily someone who believes that divorce is wrong from the standpoint of the Bible. This is someone who's just evaluating the issue socially, and she's come to the conclusion that divorce is very harmful. And you can read the book and look at that evaluation. But it goes. My point here is it's not just something for a year or two or 5 years, but it goes on for a long time. Maybe some of you here are growing up or have grown up in a family that was a marriage that was not able to stay together. That was not my experience, and I'll tell you this much. If I look back to my teenage years and what it meant for me when I was growing up, if my father would not have been in the house, I grew up on a farm, if he would have not been around on the farm and involved in my life, I don't know where I'd be. I really don't know where I'd be. I got in enough trouble with Dad being there, okay? And if Dad wouldn't have been there, I can't imagine what would have happened in my life. And so, I have no doubt that this is a big issue. Donald Miller, in his book, The Own Dragon, says if a kid grows up feeling he's burdening people around him, he's going to operate as though the world doesn't want him. I didn't recognize these feelings myself until the last few years in my late 20s and early 30s, but it has always been there. Those feelings and the realities, the dynamics involved with being a child that grows up without dad and mom. Tim Elmore, in his book, Generation IY, and I recommend that for you, talks about how as young people in our culture, or as all of us, move along through life from childhood into adolescence and adulthood. There's stages that go through that. We learn to do things at a certain age, and then, you know, by the time we're two or three, we should be walking, or even before, we should learn to walk, and then we, somewhere along the line, at 5 years old, we learn to feed ourselves, and then we, at six or seven or eight, we learn to read, and, you know, there's a two-year window here on some of those kind of things. But if someone gets to be 12 years old and they don't know how to feed themselves, you know, that person is handicapped, right? And obviously there are handicapped people, but under normal circumstances, you know, there are certain things that have to be accomplished. And these go in for their physical areas, and I'll talk more about that in a little bit. Physical areas and other areas, but there's times where as we go through life, we get to the toll booth of maturity, and we pay our toll and learn how to read. We pay our toll and learn how to bathe ourselves, it's so simple. But we pay our toll and we take that next step of maturity. And what Tim Elmore is saying in this book as he evaluates this generation is that this generation, in many areas, we get to the toll booth and we don't ever pay the toll. We don't ever reach that area of maturity. We refuse, or we're allowed to, or we even in some cases expected to, not pay the toll. And we never reach that next level of maturity. And this was an example. This is my daughter. She babysits a girl sometimes. And this is an 8-year-old girl. And this 8-year-old girl was telling her, this 8-year-old girl's grandmother was telling my daughter the other week that the little girl is going to need some help to shower herself because she can't shower herself. And she's going to need your help. And here's how to do it. And here's what you do. Here's the little spongy thing and all this. And here's the soap. And my daughter grew up in a family where, you know, when you're 8 years old, you're on your own in the shower. You know, it is high time to be able to take care of your own hair and wash behind your own ear. And you can mess up a little bit, but when you come out, mom will check you and send you back in there if you need to. But you're going to do it yourself when you're 8 years old, right? That little 8-year-old girl, the reason I thought about it, so I was getting ready for this talk, that little 8-year-old girl is not paying the toll on getting her in bed. And I'm wondering how many other times is her family going to allow her take a detour on that maturity, that's the next toll booth in her levels of maturity. That's what's going on in our culture. You can take this right on to learn to work, right? Learning to respect authority. Learning to buy a car and provide your own transportation. Those are all areas of maturity as you go through life. Those are expectations in our culture. And for many young people, they're not paying the toll. They refuse to pay the toll. I have a He had a neighbor whose son graduated from high school, and he did what a lot of American people do. They go to college. He went to college for 4 years. He didn't really know what he wanted to do, so he did what a lot of American people do. He decided to go get a master's degree. I don't know what I want to do, but I'm sure not going to work. So he got a master's degree, and he got a master's degree in social studies. And he got credentialed on paper. He got credentialed to become a social studies teacher in public high school. He spent 6 years in college learning to become a social studies teacher in high school, and I thought, wow, when he gets done, he's going to get a good job. And you know what he did? He didn't have the social skills, he didn't have the ability to go to some school and get that school to hire him to become a teacher. Okay? He didn't have the social skills and the drive and the motivation and all those kind of things. He never paid that toll. And so, guess what? My neighbor is working at Advanced Auto Parts for $8.50 an hour selling auto parts with a social studies 6-year master's degree. He's working at Advanced Auto Parts. Now, I don't have a problem working at Advanced Auto Parts. That's fine. But the problem is 6 years of college to do it, right? And it's his dad's money. That guy never paid the toll to do what he had to do to actually become a social studies teacher, become mature enough to get to that point. I'm making my point. We're in many ways in our culture, we're not reaching maturity, and we refuse to pay that toll. Typically, children should mature in four areas. You have the biological area, that's the physical. We grow up, we get exercise, we eat good food, we sleep, and we eventually get to be 5'10" or 6 foot tall or whatever, and we grow up physically. The second area is that we mature cognitively and intelligence. We learn to think. We can be logical. We're to mature in those areas. And the third area is we mature socially. We know how to relate to our friends. We know how to relate to our family members. Relate to people in authority, the lady next door. We learn social interactions in church and community and whatever. Areas that we mature, and you also mature emotionally in matters of the heart. You learn how to feel deeply, care for other people. You learn how to control your anger. You learn the emotional thing, I think, is actually a matter of the heart. It's a spiritual matter where we learn about God, and that might be an expansion of the emotional part of it a little bit. But we should, typically children should, as we grow up, we should mature in all these areas. And what a person who refuses to pay toll in all those areas, a young person who either refuses or is allowed to refuse to pay toll in those areas of maturity, that person grows up lopsided. And I believe that would describe the generation of children that you work with in your kids' clubs. They're very mature in some areas, but extremely immature in other areas. How many people understand what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Very, very mature in some ways, like amazing. What they know, what they can do in some areas, but extremely immature in other areas. Today's children, youth have grown up lopsided, pitifully behind in some areas. Tim Elmore said there's no correlation between giftedness and maturity. Just because you have talent and you're able to Google something and come up with really cool stuff off the internet doesn't mean you're mature, right? Doesn't mean you know how to work hard or respect authority or get along with peers or to impact the world. So this is an evaluation of the youth of the day and the young people that I'm sure that you're working with in our communities and our schools and whatever. And at this point in my evaluation of it, to be honest with you, I get a little discouraged. You know, it's pretty bad. The children of today are the adults of tomorrow, so you think about that and it gets kind of spirit. Jeremiah says, stand at the crossroads and look. Ask for ancient paths. Ask where the good way is and walk in it, and you will find rest for your soul. I think it's important that we evaluate. How can you as a teacher, how can you as a kids club worker or adoptive parent or mentor, how can you impact this mess? Because it is a mess. And to be honest with you, I have spent a little too much time just saying something like, oh God, would you just come back? You know, I just want to die, go to heaven, and have this all be over with. And you didn't come in this workshop here to say that. That sounds like something an old man would say. And so I feel kind of guilty when I say that to myself. I look at it and say, you know, wouldn't it be a great time for God to come back? And it would be, and I'd be fine with that. And I've been challenged and convicted for that attitude because I'm only 46. And God grants me a lot. I have a lot of life ahead of me yet. And people like Merle Buckholder and Wayne Schrock, you were here last night and heard Wayne Schrock's message, convict me for that attitude. And I believe that you and I are at a time where we can rise up and do things to influence this generation like never before. And so that's what I want to spend the rest of our time talking about when we evaluate this. Today's children, today's youth need challenges in three areas. They need challenges in emotional intelligence to learn how to manage themselves and be aware of themselves, to control their emotions, to manage their relationships. These are areas that are under mature. We have a lot of children in the world today that are growing up in a single parent or in a very small family. And in a small family, a single child home, a child that grows up in a single child home starts to think that the whole world revolves around them. And that child needs somebody to help him become aware of how his relationships look with other people. Because in a single child family, he thinks he's the king of the world. And everybody waits on him and brings him everything he needs. I think one thing would help any child is to grow up in a larger family. And you know, when you grow up in a large family, little Johnny goes to the drawer and we're going to pull out his socks, his favorite pair of blue socks. Well, guess what? His brother already ripped them off. and they're going. And so the little guy realizes that, you know what, the world doesn't revolve around me, and I got to go find my little brother and get those socks off him if I'm going to wear it, and there's going to be a little challenge there. And as that process happens day in and day out, the child learns to become self-aware. He learns to manage his relationships and the give and take of that. But in many children in our culture don't know how to do that because they don't have emotional intelligence. Another area that they need us to influence is their moral intelligence. Could you tell me when I'm supposed to be done? I'm
almost checked. 3:00.
Okay. Thank you. Another area is moral intelligence. We need to challenge young people to have personal discipline, to be honest, to be in a culture where we learn to work hard, we have a sense of self, we have strong spiritual values. We need to challenge young people on who God is and where I fit and where you fit in God's plan for life. Youth of today need to be called to something big, be called to something bigger than themselves. I believe that we're asking too little of young people today. And we're asking too little of troubled children. We have to ask them for something more, something with meaning, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. And the third area is we need to expect children to lead. We need to expect them to contribute to other people. Even troubled children, the most troubled children, have something to offer somebody else. Our little motto at camp is that the reason we come to camp is to help ourselves and help others. And when you can take that snotty-nosed little brat that's been thrown out of his classroom and help him learn to help somebody else, he's making a lot of progress at that point. In his own, in all these areas, emotionally and morally, and when he gets to the place where he can lead somebody else, and he can teach another boy to simply make his bed, or teach another boy to remember his stuff he needs to take a shower, and you know, all those kind of things, help another boy clean a lantern and 101 other things. And you teachers, I want to challenge you to use that. When you have that troubled boy or girl that's driving you crazy in your classroom, find a way to get that child to help you teach. Imagine that. Don't kick him out of your classroom. Get him to do your job for you. I think that's what he needs. Now, that you're probably going to... Yeah, you'll have a lot of fun figuring out how to do that, and I'll let you do that. I'm a teacher. But I do believe in that principle that most troubled child needs to help somebody else, needs to contribute somewhere. And we can find ways to do that as teachers and kids club members or whatever. I mean, expect children to lead others and to, yeah, contribute to the lives of other people. I want to talk to you. I told you to begin this talk that one of the main things that I think we need to accomplish here today is work in our own hearts and who we are as people. If we're going to reach out and help troubled children, we need to take a hard look at who we are and what we're about. And I have three things that I want to challenge you with as we close out here. And the first thing here is to live your life in such a way that you have a sense of purpose. Proverbs says, where there is no vision, the people perish. And this is really a spiritual issue. There's so many people and young people in our culture that are just drifting along that are not living for God. They're just drifting along. If you don't believe me, go to Walmart some night. On Friday evening, some night, when the place is full, and just sit on a bench and watch people. There's a lot of people that don't know why they're in Walmart. They don't even know why they're on planet Earth. And there's people that do not have a sense of purpose. And if you and I are going to influence our culture and our young people, we have to have a sense of purpose. Somebody said, if you set yourself on fire, the whole world will come to watch you burn. I will tell you that a person that says in their heart to God, I will do what you want me to do. I'll be what you want me to be. I'll swim wide rivers and climb tall mountains. Whatever you want me to do, oh God, that's what I'll do. That person that has a sense of purpose in their life that troubled young people will pay attention to eventually. Merle Burkholder said it so well the other day in his workshop. He said, get your life in a position where when God asks you a question, you already say yes. Before he even gets done asking the question, when God says, would you do this? Your default setting is yes. Yes, God. If you make that happen in your life, you will have an adventurous life. You'll never run out of opportunities when you just constantly say yes to God, and you have that kind of sense of purpose. And frankly, I'm inspired by you being here today, because I'm looking at a crowd of young people, really. Thank you. And I have opportunities at Kingdom to work with some of the finest young people in the Mennonite Church, and I'm inspired by the young people who have made this commitment. I'm going to do what you want me to do. I'm not sure if I'll live through it, but I'm going to do it. To just say yes to God, that's an important thing when you have that kind of purpose. The young people of today are watching you. Somebody said, actually that's in this little book here, Arnold says in this book that you're going to get, he says, don't worry if kids don't obey you. Worry that they're watching. You think about that a little bit, teachers. You like when they obey you, right? We all. But don't worry if they don't obey you. Worry that they're watching. And I think that's important. When we set ourselves on fire, it's important that we have purpose in life. I had a boy at camp here a couple years ago. His name is Keli. And Keli explained to me one time, at camp, he got to live with some young men in his group. His chiefs in his group were young men that had a sense of purpose and knew what they were about. Woke up early in the morning, grabbed their Bible, read their Bible. These are young men, his chiefs, that knew why they were on planet Earth, and they had a plan for their days. And when they woke up Keli in the morning, they had fire in their eyes, and they were ready to go today. There was a sense of purpose that he saw in all the staff at camp. And one day he explained to me what it's like to have a dad with no sense of purpose. In his family, his dad slept until noon. And then he would watch TV all afternoon. And then he would, to drown his own pain, take some drugs. And then somewhere about evening, he'd start to drool because he was on too many drugs and couldn't even control his body functions. And Keli explains to me with tears in his eyes what it's like to have a dad with no sense of purpose. Set yourself on fire, people, and the troubled young people that you're working around will come and watch you learn. If you want a little more reason to have a sense of purpose, I gotta tell you a quick story. And my board chairman is back there in the corner, so he's going to remember this story. But 20 years ago, 25 years ago, in 1994, we were trying to get a license to start Bald Eagle Boys Camp. And a couple of us went down to Harrisburg to try to get a license. We went in the children and youth office, and we asked for a license, and we explained how we're going to start this really cool camp. We're going to camp out in the woods, we're going to live in the trees, and we're going to cook over a fire, and we're going to kill some squirrels. Now, we probably didn't tell them that. But we outlined our program to these people in their offices, children and youth offices in Harrisburg, and we got done laying this out. They basically said, there's no way we're going to let you do that. You can't live out in a tent in the woods in Pennsylvania. You'll freeze to death. And so we went back to camp and rethought, and we came up with some more arguments and wrote some papers, and we went back to Harrisburg again, and we said, hey, we really want to do this. We're really nice people, and we really love you, and we love the boys, and we're going to help them, and you can trust us. And everything's going to be fine. And they said, once again, no way in the world. The guy who was the representative in our region said, there's no way in the world we're going to let you ever do what you're asking us to do, start a camp in central Pennsylvania. And we left that meeting. And as we left the meeting, I believe it was you, Dwight. I don't know if it was you or Eugene, but one of our guys that was in the meeting, the boss of the guy that was in our region said, I'm never going to let you do that. His boss, his name is Richard, pulled one of our guys behind the door, and he said to him, hey, I'm going to get you a license. But you kind of have to work through this a little bit with Jerry. He's going to make you work for some things, and he's making it sound impossible, but I'm just telling you, we're going to get you a license. We're going to help you get started. And then we left there and felt a little better about it. Wasn't real sure what was going on there. But what we found out sometime later is that Richard, he's the man that was in charge of our central region. He would be Jerry's boss. Richard grew up in Harrisburg. He would have been, if I remember right, he'd been like in his 50s at that time. This is back in 94. He grew up in Harrisburg. He remembers as a boy going to Hurst Street Mennonite Church and going to their two-week vacation Bible school. Richard knew a little something about Mennonites. As he sat in his office in his position of authority at 50 years old, he knew a little something about Mennonites and their integrity to God before. He knew a little something about their integrity and their honesty. He knew a little something about how well the Mennonites do in working the church. And he's the one that said, okay, so for those of you who are working with signing those little youngsters in vacation Bible schools or kids club, you don't know what that young person is going to grow up to be 30 years from now, what position of authority that person will have, will potentially impact an awful lot of people. Think about it. If we would have never gotten the license to start Baldy Boys Camp, today there's over 500 boys that have gone through that program that have been impacted by the love of Jesus Christ at Bald Eagle because Richard said, of course God could find a way to get us a license without Richard's help. But look how that works. When somebody took some time to do some kind of little program with some little child, it makes an impact that can last for eternity. So have a sense of purpose in your life. The second thing is to have rules. When you work with children, you have to have boundaries. You have to have rules. I have an honest friend that has a red mule that is absolutely worthless because he said this mule doesn't know how to work with a team. And so this red mule lives on his farm and eats all the hay and all the grass, but he can't get any good out of it because the mule doesn't know how to stay inside of boundaries. It doesn't know how to stay in the harness. And a person that grows up, a young person that grows up and never pays the toll of learning how to respect authority is a fairly worthless person. I know that in God's economy that's not true. God loves everybody. I know that. But a person that don't know how to respect authority and stay inside of boundaries is a person that's in a lot of trouble. Nearly worthless in our culture. I think that as we work with children, we have to have rules, we have to have boundaries, and I want to use this little graphic to kind of illustrate as the child gets older to open those boundaries up and to be okay with crossing those boundaries. It's kind of a sloppy process. When you make a rule, expect it to be broken, especially by a troubled child, all right? When you make a rule, if that kid's got anything to him at all, if he has any of my respect, he's going to break your rule, okay? And that's just part of the territory. But you need to set boundaries even though he will cross them and find a way to give consequences and be ready for that testing. Don't take it too personal just because it breaks your rule. Your little living rule. He's going to break it. And you don't have to take it so personal. Just be secure enough in who you are. Help him through the consequences and help him learn what it means to respect authority. I have a story about elephants that I'm running out of time on. But it's basically a story about in Africa there was a park where they needed some elephants, so they took a whole bunch of small elephants or immature elephants, youth adolescent elephants, over to this area in this park because adolescent elephants are about half as hard to load on a truck as a full-grown elephant. So they took 20 teenage elephants, if you will, took them over to this park, and they turned them loose, and they wanted to introduce elephants into that area. What happened was that these elephants went crazy. And they beat each other up, they knocked down trees, they attacked people, and they found out that adolescent elephants or teenage elephants need adult elephants around to knock them down every once in a while. And so what they did is they simply went back to the place where the herd of elephants originally was. They got three adult bull elephants, brought them over and unloaded them into the teenage elephants, and the bulls, as they walked into that herd of teenage elephants, these teenage little bulls that were running around, the big bulls just came over and they slowly kind of butted them and knocked them on their rear. And the adolescents started learning that, you don't act like that. And it's an interesting story, and I'd love to tell you more about it. The third thing that I think we need to know about ourselves is we work with troubled children, we need to have fun. And basically, this needs to have a relationship. 1 John says there's no fear in love. Perfect love drives out fear because fear has to do with punishment. The one who fears is not made perfect in love. We have to say yes sometimes. Of course we need rules, but we also need to say yes. Sure, we can do that. We can't always say no to everything. And I think that it's important that we do things in our relationship with children to build relationships and get closer to them, to have fun with them. Some wise man told me years ago, one of the troubled children, that if you take all the boys you're working with and pick the worst one out, the one that you struggle with the most, and find a way to enjoy that boy, you'll be fine. And I think that's true. I found that to be true in 25 years, that you pick the one that you struggle with the most and learn to enjoy them. All of us want to be enjoyed. Remember what it's like to be a child and you were enjoyed by your parents? You're enjoyed by your Sunday school teacher or whatever. Find a way to enjoy that that child. Relationships are broken in our culture today. The family has fallen apart, and in a small families, broken families we're working with today, there's so little opportunity for a child to learn relationship. Participate in strawberry fights. We used to grow strawberries. Our family used to grow strawberries when we lived up in Lock Haven. And I used to get some of the young people from the community to come in and help us pick strawberries. And you pick strawberries for an hour or two every morning for a month, you soon get tired of it. And what used to happen is they get tired of picking strawberries, so they start throwing strawberries at each other. And I get all mad and I'll be like, wait a minute, wait, stop. We need to pick strawberries. We're trying to sell these things. And thank you. I learned one day that you know what I need to do? Is I need to get some strawberries and participate in this strawberry fight. So that's what we did. And you'd be surprised what changes sometimes when you just simply say yes. It's a spiritual battle. We need to have rules. We need to have rules and we need to have fun. But I think we need to also recognize that we need to go back. We need to, like I said, go back. We say I'm strong. We need to feed our plowshares and swords, our pruning hooks and the spears, and participate in the battle for the souls of the young people that God has entrusted us with. Thank you, God.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.